Blog Talk Radio.
Officially cue my participation here. Welcome, everyone. You're listening to This Week in Oncology on the Blog Talk Radio Network. I am your producer and co-host, Greg Masters, and I'm joined in my virtual booth today by my partner and in co-conspirator here, Dr. Richard Just. Rich, you with us?
I'm with you. Welcome, Jack.
Thank you.
And we just want to preface our remarks today that on an earlier show of This Week in Health Innovation, and oh, by the way, This Week in Oncology is brought to you by this healthinnovationmedia.com, we had a rather a massive failure on our broadcast, and only later to learn that Blog Talk Radio had a power failure in their data center. And so we were unsuccessful in our 10 a.m. broadcast. Now, we're led to believe that things are copacetic, and so far the dashboard and the controls look good, and they seem to be working. So let's tee our program up today. I'm going to tell you about our special guest. That'd be Howard Jack West, M.D., is the medical director of thoracic oncology program at Swedish Cancer Institute, and also the president and CEO of Global Resource for Advancing Cancer Education, known by the acronym of GRACE, in Seattle, Washington. And Dr. West is making an encore appearance on This Week in Oncology. In fact, we went back to the records and found that our previous chat with Dr. West was February 12, 2012. So almost 2 years to the date, we're going to get to hear more from this individual. And the genesis of the chat today follows a review of an article that he was a lead author on titled A New Model, Physician-Patient Collaboration in Online Communities and the Clinical Practice of Oncology. So rather than get into the gist here, I'm going to hand it over to you, Rich. Help us get to know Dr. West and some of the message inherent in that study that we referred to.
Well, thanks, Greg. Again, welcome, Jack. I appreciate you coming on the show today.
Happy to.
The article is very, very interesting. And as a matter of fact, I just left my office to come home to do the show, and I asked one of my partners an internet question, and it had to do with Twitter and so forth. And he says, oh, I just can't deal with it. I just don't have time to deal with that. I watch my son spend 1 hour twice a day handling his emails and his tweets, and I just don't have the time to do that. And that struck a chord with me because I find myself waking up at 4 in the morning to get through all of my communications. And by the time I get to the office, my inbox is filled up already. So one of the key points of your article was the physicians being loath to engage in online communities, and one of their concerns is time limitations. So maybe we could talk about or start by talking out about your experiences in this area, and where you see that we're going, you know, with all of this.
Well, I think that the time limitations are a real issue. I mean, I know very few people who say that the problem is they have so much time and so little to do, and even fewer oncologists who feel that way. And very often we are, seeing patients all day long, and new patients are coming in and of course, fearful, and it's a very high priority to them. And so the priorities and the time limitation is real. I think we all have difficulty balancing our professional obligations, our personal obligations, and sleep and other necessities. But I think at the same time, it's really an issue where if we don't do it, it's only going to get harder, because the fact is that more and more patients, and by that I mean people, are going online for everything. And, I had my son, I tried to teach him, I don't remember what it was, but some how to do this thing. And he said, I don't need it. Whatever you're going to teach me, I can learn better online. And that was humbling, but probably true. That the fact is that, kids today, that YouTube is the second biggest search engine, and people, if you want to know how to wrap a present or, whatever you want to learn how to do, there's YouTube videos about it, and there's tons of other information online. And Dr. Google is now everyone's favorite doctor, at least by, if you go follow where people are going, over 80% of people look to Google for information about health, and that's probably especially true in cancer, because it's both very serious, and it's usually not an immediate emergency. I mean, you can't really go look online for crushing substernal chest pain if you've got that. That's something you have to go and deal with right away. But cancer is often something that you have enough time to figure out your options in the light of day, and it's worth caring about. So because of this, it's incredibly amenable to looking online for your options. And the point is, if we don't do that, it's that nature hates a vacuum, and so does the internet. People are just going to find whatever is out there, and that could be very poor quality information. The fact is that people, caregivers, patients, are going to be motivated to find what they can. And whether that is a boon or a real challenge entirely depends on the quality of the information that's available to them. If it is good quality information, then it'll help corroborate, or, patients will instantly know the right questions to ask, and things that a doctor might be talking about will have a flicker of recognition, or hopefully just tweaking things that are read online. On the other hand, if what is available online is only unrealistic stuff from people profiting on people's hopes, then it's just going to undermine the doctor. So, my conviction has been that it's something that we kind of need to do, but it can be the difference between being an obstacle and an effective tool if we get the right information available online. I'll also just say that it's a remarkably efficient tool. That the fact is, it's so easy to amplify everything online. I mean, you can retweet stuff, you can, send it through the Facebook community, and that's the virality of it is potentially great or potentially awful, depending on the information that's out there. So for me, one of the big advantages of trying to basically upload everything I know and do is that I could have a very productive opinion, second opinion with one person, and that could be very gratifying, but it evaporates right into the walls around you, and so it only helps that one person for the time you spend. But if you put that information online, then all of a sudden it's available to everybody everywhere forever, and it's a remarkably efficient way to transmit good information.
Well, those are very good points. I was just when you were talking about your child, the immediate picture that came into my mind was I have a 5-year-old grandson who's has Down syndrome. And I remember about, I guess it was 2 years ago or maybe even more, he was eyeing my iPhone. And I turned to my daughter and I said, is it okay for him to play with this? You know, so she says, sure, he knows how to use it. And the kid took my iPhone, sat down on the floor, started scrolling through the icons, clicked on the one that he wanted, which was a yoga program, by the way, and started dancing to the music and to the program. And I was absolutely flabbergasted. I mean, not only is he an extremely bright kid, even with his disability, but somebody that young knows exactly how to use these things. So it was a lesson as to the coming generation and how prevalent this issue is going to be, that we, as you say, either have to get involved or we're leaving a vacuum that somebody's going to fill.
Exactly. Nowadays, a lot of people, and I think it's shifting from the young up, really expect to have information completely at their fingertips. Things that, you should be able to play Trivial Pursuit with a smartphone. It would, and you get 15 seconds to find your answer. It'd change the world. I mean, we are used to being able to find every bit of trivia with, in real time. And it's all available on your, on something you carry with you. Eventually we'll be doing wearable computing and Google Glass. And, people will expect to have all the information they want in, right in front of them. So I think we are beholden to deliver at least something to tide them over till the live encounter. But again, I think it's not really a punishment. It's a point that you could either have the same conversation about the side effects of a drug or, mutation testing or, the advantages and disadvantages of having a port or whatever it is. You could have... Mm-hmm. We do have these conversations over and over, but imagine that you had an information prescription that you could provide. That, I think, is a potential time-saving tool. Beyond that, I think the other real issue is that we now live in a world where everything is changing so quickly that no single person has all of the access to the best information. Even if you specialize in one or two types of cancer, but especially if you're a general oncologist, it's just not feasible and it's not realistic to expect that your doctor is going to be the source of all useful information. My concern is that the more information that there's an ever-escalating volume of content out there, new markers, new trials, new drugs, the more potential there is for any doctor to become a bottleneck. And so you need these redundant systems where it's not just a doctor and a patient in the room, but it's augmented by all the cumulative knowledge available in a networked community. And the fact is, even though I focus in lung cancer, I learn online about, I've learned about ROS1 as a mutation and the effectiveness of that treatment. I've learned about results of clinical trials from patients because it's like people come back with information to the hive and say, hey, here's what I found. What do you think? And it's remarkably more efficient than just hoping you encounter it at some point at ASCO once a year.
Right, right. Yeah, I've been impressed that initially – when somebody would come in with a stack of papers that they downloaded from the internet, it would be like my worst nightmare. They would say, in your spare time, which I know you have none, can you read through all of this and let me know what you think? And nowadays, that happens less and less frequently because people are getting more familiar with how to search and with what their condition actually is, that they're bringing in pertinent material. So it is very helpful. because I'm like you. I'm inundated every minute by questions that I have to answer, and it's hard to focus, you know, and we actually need some help. And if we can get some help from the patients themselves, that's terrific.
Absolutely. And my point about this is that everyone has to adjust from the 1970s version of, you know, the view of medicine that doctors knew everything about everything, that's not reasonable, that doctors can't see it as their personal failing for not knowing every new publication about acquired resistance to a rare mutation. But the point is that, you know, we can help work with the patients and review the options. But, you know, for that patient, if they have a 1 or 2% mutation, and they have the motivation and the time to seek out every bit of information in the remotest parts of the, you know, the online world. And so if there is an expert in the field talking about this and new trial options or new drugs, then, you know, that they can go down that rabbit hole and it could potentially be very fruitful. It's not necessarily realistic for someone seeing 20 patients with, you know, 15 different cancers over the course of the day to do hours of research on every single person's condition. So I think if we welcome that and patients understand that them coming in with something that the doctor's not necessarily aware of is not undermining them, nor should the doctor feel, you know, the ego hit of not knowing everything about everything.
Right. Well, you just quoting from your article about what you just mentioned, the amount of information that is now being published, you cited that PubMed currently categorizes more than 21 million citations, with new publications being added at a rate of approximately one per minute, a rate that has more than doubled over the past 20 years. And the number of medical journals has also increased. This is especially true for oncology, where there are now approximately 180 journals covering just this one area of clinical subspecialty practice. I mean, that's awesome, and it's almost incomprehensible. I know that I can't even pronounce some of the new drugs. I don't know where they dream up the names, but there are so many of them, and they're so hard. They're all tongue twisters. That it's understandable that none of us can be expected to remember all of this. And
I mean, it's an enviable problem to have, that the field has advanced so much that there are new subgroups and mutations and new targets for specific populations. And this is a champagne problem. But the point is, all of this information is only of value if somebody knows about it who can use it. And it's not feasible for people to keep up with that torrent with a human brain, one human brain.
Right. That's right. One of the other issues that you, well, actually two other issues that you mentioned as part of your key points were the legal liability and patient privacy issues that have delayed physicians from getting involved in this field. And I wonder if you could just comment on whether there's been any improvement in that area or addressing those particular issues.
I think the main improvement is in people becoming increasingly aware of how to engage and behave online. You know, we are all somewhat active in social media, and there are things that you learn. Obviously, you have to treat the social media world at least the way you treat speaking on an elevator, so you're not going to use identifiable information. I have been now operating the Grace website for 5-6 years now, and for six and a half years now, and people ask questions all the time, and I give answers, but you don't tell people what they should do. You have general discussions mm-hmm. about concepts, and so it's really just it's a way you learn to talk, just the way we learn to think in probabilities, and you don't say always, never, or as if we know the exact prognosis of a patient. It's a language and a way of thinking, and you become circumspect, and I think that's really what it takes. That I've fielded literally thousands and thousands of questions, terabytes of information, going back and forth on the website now, me and many of my colleagues, largely in lung cancer and then some others. But, if somebody asks a question of what should I do for my acquired resistance for an EGFR mutation now that I've progressed on erlotinib, you don't say, here's what you should do. You say, well, here are the leading options that we might consider. And sometimes you could say, well, and in this case, something like this, I often do X. It's basically conveying the ideas, but you're giving people the tools to go back to their own physician and medical team. You're not giving a directive of what to do to someone who isn't your patient. And by the mm-hmm. same token, I think you just need to be cautious about not engaging in, personal direct discussions with patients on Facebook or whatever it is. So these are skills to learn, but they're absolutely learnable.
Mm-hmm. Right. That's very good advice. One thing that Greg and I have been interested in is tumor boards, and we have had tumorboard.com as a domain that we've registered. And one part of this is to have the patients participate in the tumor board discussion some way. I was wondering what your thought of this possibility was. We've interviewed Don Dijon, who stated that he was at an institution where they did have patients participate in tumor boards. My experience has been sort of spotty, but it's part of this involvement of patients in their own care, the scheme of things. So I was just wondering what your opinion is of that possibility.
Well, I think it's interesting. I think there's a bit of an element of a visit to the sausage factory to see the debate back and forth. I mean, some of it's messy. I can think of mm-hmm. – I have a very vibrant thoracic oncology tumor board, which I think is really an acid test of the vitality of a program. We have a lot of mutual respect for each other, but we also have disagreements about whether and when to do surgery in a oligometastatic disease or whatever. There are a lot of cases, and I know for people who work in oncology, you can understand that there's a lot that doesn't have clear rules that we have to live by, because a lot of real-world people wouldn't be allowed on the clinical trials because people do have concurrent other medical illnesses, renal failure, et cetera. And a lot of times we do have to make decisions about how to treat a lung cancer in a patient with a wheelchair from MS. And mm-hmm. these are really challenging issues. So I think it's really on the GRACE website, and I think as a general concept, it makes sense to not shield patients from the complexity of knowing that there isn't one right answer that comes down written on stone tablets, but really that there is room for uncertainty. And I think the best way is to have patients have a sense of the range of options and the pros and cons of each, and hopefully mm-hmm. for you and the patient to achieve some consensus about a best way to go. I think it's an mm-hmm. interesting idea. I do think that it might be hard to have as frank a discussion about the probabilities of is this really just somebody who brings up the idea of doing a local therapy for someone with metastatic disease. You know, we often will have debates about why are we even doing this? Does this make sense? And I think one challenge would be that it's when you integrate a lot of emotion into it, I don't know that that will make it a better process. I think that obviously the patient is often going to be advocating for an approach which may or may not be the one that the evidence would suggest is the right thing to do. So I think it's a tough call. I mean, many times we don't have brutal conversations that are disrespectful to the patients, but at the same time, it's a lot of times a frank assessment that that would not be the same discussion you'd have with the patient. And I think it is hard to have a conversation. You know, we have a certain level of jargon, frankly, that we can't help but use, and there are shortcuts, really, in our discussions that we use, especially when you're going through the cases every 5 or 8 minutes in the tumor board, that I think would be challenging for patients to pick up. And I think that's an aspirational goal that we're not there yet.
Right. Well, thank you for your thoughts. That's very helpful. How do you see the incorporation of these various modalities like Twitter, you know, Facebook, and so forth and so on in your daily practice? We mentioned the time limitations and so forth and so on, but are you on Twitter all day long? Or
no, I'm not. I will check it, you know, if I'm waiting for a patient who's late or, you know, various moments. I use it as a tool. I think many or most of us use Twitter as much as a tool for information gathering as for disseminating. I will post certain things I observe or, you know, write, et cetera. But a lot of times it's going to be the opportunity that I have first to learn about the results of a clinical trial that are being released as a press release. Oftentimes the folks in the pharma industry or, you know, the analysts will be conveying that before it gets out to the medical community. So, you know, it's certainly practical for me to learn about this information in basically real time. I learn about articles, various publications in journals or in newspapers or whatever it is. From that. But I also obviously would note that patients are having these conversations, patients and caregivers, independent of the docs, and I think that can be a very valuable thing. When I have patients come back asking about various drugs that I might not be familiar with, I mean, there's thousands of drugs and thousands of trials in development that none of us can become experts in, and oftentimes it's the motivated patients who come back. They're talking with each other. They learn about side effects or encouraging drugs, and it gives us the lead to follow.
Mm-hmm. Right. I'm thinking of the research that was done on coronary artery dissection that you mentioned in the book, and that's where a research initiative came out of a patient-driven effort. So we don't really have enough time to talk about all the ramifications of this, but...
I think that's a tool that we will get into, especially with unusual subgroups. I mean, we have these geographically dispersed groups of people. They can help find each other and, you know, alert each other to the availability of a phase 2 trial and be motivated to complete them in a way that we've never been able to think about it before. So I think it's actually going to accelerate the pace of progress in the field.
Right. Well, we're going to have to hold it right there because we're running out of time. I really appreciate your coming on today and giving us your thoughts about the use of social media and various other modalities to communicate. Thank you once again.
Well, it's a pleasure. You take care. Hopefully we'll catch up in less than 2 years. Okay.
I hope so.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.